listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The President of Ecuador, Lenin Moreno, has issued a threat against Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks publisher who was granted asylum in Ecuador's London embassy by the country's previous president, Rafael Correa. In a tweet and a television interview, Moreno declared he would, quote, take measures, close quote, against Assange unless he stops intervening in the politics and affairs of other nations. Moreno tweeted, quote, to Mr. Assange, we have put a condition that he stop intervening in politics and self-determination of the country, otherwise measures will be taken, close quote. For more on that, we spoke with Joe Loria. He's the editor of the ConsortiumNews.com website. The current edition has at its banner VIP's pleas for humanitarian asylum for Julian Assange. We spoke with him via Skype from Washington on Tuesday.
Yes, we've just posted this morning a new Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity memo. And these are memos that started way back in 2003, the first one being to George Bush to tell him not to invade Iraq because there are no WMDs. That gave credibility to VIPs since they were right. They're one of the few who said so before.
A couple $1 trillion and thousands, if not millions, of lives ago.
Later, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's something to laugh at, really, but it's so bad that... So today's VIPs memo is pleading for humanitarian asylum for Julian Assange. Now, this is clearly the story of the moment because the Ecuadorian government, the new Ecuadorian government of Lenin Moreno, unlike the principled government previously, wants to make what they can out of what they're holding, an incredible chip, a man that the United States is desperate for, who's inside the London embassy of Ecuador, and that, of course, is the publisher and founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. So they, the previous Ecuadorian government gave him asylum because he was revealing facts truths based on raw material of cables and other documents that had been given to WikiLeaks by whistleblowers or hackers, people who had access to it, that were verified as being absolutely correct. And nobody's ever accused, well, they've accused, but no one's ever proven that WikiLeaks has published anything that's false.
Right.
And that things were retracted, names were redacted, rather, that would not endanger any agents. So this system that WikiLeaks started is endangered because Julian Assange is stuck inside the embassy in Ecuador. I think your listeners know the whole story about he was accused by some women in Sweden. He was never charged of any crime whatsoever. But he was fearful that, and his lawyers are fearful that if he were arrested or if he left the embassy, he would be arrested by British authorities and sent to the United States, where they believe here in Northern Virginia, where I'm speaking from, there is a sealed indictment against him. And it will be very difficult to prosecute Julian Assange on the crimes that they are accusing him of, because he's a publisher. He's not the thief. He's not the person who stole the documents.
Right.
He just simply received them. However, we do have to look closely at the law here for a second, because I have my first book was with Senator Mike Gravel. Some of your older listeners would know who he was. He was in the Senate, U.S. Senate, from 1969 to 1980.
Yep.
And Mike, who I know very well right now, obviously, because I've worked with him closely on this book when he was running for president in the primary against Obama and Hillary Clinton in 2008. Mm. Mike was in the Senate, and Dan Ellsberg, who had the Pentagon Papers, was trying to get, before he went to the newspapers, he wanted to go to someone in Congress to have them read the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record, because in the Constitution there's an amendment that says any member of Congress cannot be questioned on anything that he does in the going to or from a legislative act. That means you can stand up in Congress, in the Senate, in the House, even outside. Doesn't have to even be on Capitol Hill, even in a local hall somewhere, if it is a legal meeting of the Congress, and you could say whatever you want. You cannot be arrested for that. You can divulge any classified information you want. So he went to McGovern, and he was running for president. McGovern, he turned him down. A few other senators turned him down. But Mike Gravel, who had been in the Congress only about three years, agreed, and he read the papers, Pentagon Papers, into the record. So Mike could not get into any legal trouble for doing that. He was ostracized by his colleagues.
Right.
It was a big scandal. But when he then decided to publish the Pentagon Papers as a book with Beacon Press in Boston, at that point, the government could have come after him. Because what happened in the Pentagon Papers case clearly is that the Supreme Court decided that the government cannot exercise prior restraint against the publisher, because that's what the Department of Justice had done.
Right.
John Mitchell, under Nixon, had told the Post and the Washington Post and the New York Times, stop publishing these papers. And they did stop, by the way. If you saw the movie with Hanks and the Post, it's rubbish, because they, in the movie, they're heroes, they kept publishing. No. The fact is they did obey that order, but they went to court because they knew that that was legally dubious, and they went to court and they won in the Supreme Court. The government cannot tell a newspaper or Julian Assange to stop publishing anything, but after publication, they can prosecute. And this is what but it's never happened, except the John Peter Zenger case back under Bill Cosby.
Right.
Actually, it's Bill Cosby. William Cosby, the English governor of New York, prosecuted Zenger, and Zenger won, of course. He prosecuted him for publishing negative things about himself, about the government, the British local government in New York. So he is in some legal jeopardy, but that would also put then the New York Times and the Washington Post and other papers that routinely publish classified information also in legal jeopardy. And the number two lawyer at the New York Times, in a speech on the West Coast a few days ago, and we have that article on our front page too, Don, by Ray McGovern.
Yeah.
He told these judges that the New York Times is in deep doo-doo as well if the government goes after Julian Assange, because then that opens them up to the same type of prosecution. But I think that this rabid Jeff Sessions and Mike Pompeo might just do it if they get their hands on Assange. Why haven't they gotten their hands on their Assange yet? Why is everybody waiting? We hear every day he could be turned over. My belief is the Ecuadorian government and Moreno are saying, look, the United States wants something from us. Well, we're going to get something from the United States. So I think they're holding out. They're holding out, trying to squeeze the U.S. to get the best deal they possibly can for Assange. And it hasn't happened yet. And hopefully they won't come to a deal.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in there. First of all, just for our listeners, Lenin Moreno, Lenin as in Vladimir Ilyevich Lenin, Moreno, the current president of Ecuador, who was elected as a member of the same coalition that the prior president Correa, who gave Assange sanctuary, he was elected as a part of that same coalition with the full endorsement of President Correa and of the principles in the left-leaning, if not socialist, government of Ecuador. Right after he got elected, turned around and became essentially a U.S. puppet in about a million different ways. He's been introducing neoliberal ideas back into the economy. There's a whole bunch of things, and now they're starting talking about upfront trading in Julian Assange in a short term, within days, if not hours. They were talking last week.
Right.
In addition to that, the problem that that we face with this kind of stuff in general, when you're talking about the Pentagon Papers, I don't think people understand what we're talking about. There was a whole mythology about why the United States was in, at that point, 6, 7, 8 years in Vietnam with tens of thousands of dead Americans and maybe a million or so dead Vietnamese, that was countered by a file, big, massive accumulation of paper, basically, that was presented by Daniel Ellsberg that said, here's the actual history. Here, these are all the memos and all of this stuff, which is the same kind of presentation that you'll find, by the way, at WikiLeaks.org. That is not, oh, here's today's top story, but rather, oh, there's a big box of papers over there, go through it. Or there's a big box of papers over there, go through it, virtual, in electronic form. And it's the actual, fundamental raw materials that you have to look at and try to fit onto reality and say, oh, here's a letter from George Bush to, somebody saying, look, if we go into Iraq, will you make sure that I get that $300,000 check? That kind of stuff. I mean, that's a fiction, but those are the kinds of things that are in there. There's not a story saying Bush gets check from Knucklehead to invade Iraq, but rather the actual memo. And there's tons of documents like this, and the U.S. government in particular does not want you to see that stuff. And all Assange has done is provided a place for people to deposit this. It's like basically use my conference room table and open the door to the conference room so people can come through and peruse this. That's what Assange has done.
Exactly. And the Pentagon Papers revealed it was a study that Dan Ellsberg worked on when he was with the RAND Corporation. That's it, right. Revealed that the government from Johnson, in particular, the Lyndon Johnson government, was lying to the American people when they kept saying we could win this war. They knew they were losing the war from way back. And then it eventually caught up with them. And McNamara had to realize that and turned against. And then the press turned against the war, I think, because the public went out in the streets in a mass sustained protest that turned the tide of the war and turned the tide of the press and gave us an end of the war. And then there was also the whole Church Committee investigations into the intelligence agencies and all the crimes they'd committed that I think came out of this public pressure and Cy Hirsch's reporting on domestic illegality by the CIA. So there was a huge turning of events then in the 70s that, again, came from public protest. But the Pentagon Papers was in a book. So a literal book held in your hand, and you had to look in an index if you wanted to see something. Today, obviously, there are search engines, powerful ones, that are built into WikiLeaks so that you could put in your own name and then see if you're in any of these documents.
That's right.
And I have found my name in a couple of documents. So just as a byline on some stories, that, especially on the Stratford Papers. But you can look up Nixon. I don't know if he's in there. It'd be interesting. But certainly any topic you're looking for. And to just use one example of what WikiLeaks revealed was the video of the killing of innocent civilians by American pilots in Iraq, and they're also laughing about it and celebrating it.
Yeah.
This is a war crime that's on video.
On tape, yep.
That you could, anybody could see. There's no question about it. This was the deliberate targeting of civilians. Well, anyway, there was enough evidence there to go to court and try to try someone on a war crime. I'm not saying that it's 100%, you know, they would have been convicted. All kinds of things can happen, but there was evidence there, prima facie evidence of a war crime. Who goes to jail in the end of this story that WikiLeaks revealed? The pilot? The commander who sent them in the air to do that? No. The whistleblower, Chelsea Manning, who gave this to WikiLeaks. She was the one who went to jail and is now out, fortunately, because Obama did the right thing, commuting that sentence. This is the issue for WikiLeaks, the leaders that we're living under. We've seen neoliberalism from 1980 or even before that, but certainly from Reagan and Thatcher. And the neocons came in pretty strongly under George W. Bush. Their crimes, the neocons, what they do, we see immediately what disasters they've caused in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya. We see, because they're using warfare, we see the destruction of societies. But the neoliberals, it's taken 30 years for this to filter down to the American people, the Europeans, the Brits. The average person is realizing they've been screwed now by these economic policies, right. And they're fed up. So in the 2016 election in the U.S., the establishment saw insurgencies on left and right. Unfortunately, the right insurgency of Trump won, but nonetheless, the same kind of economic issues are being protested in this election and in these movements. And they are scared crap. I think they're really scared that they're going to lose hold of the population and they can't keep getting away with these policies anymore. And the press has been so subservient to the establishment that they're really no threat anymore. They've neutralized the media by first consolidation of ownership, then by gutting budgets for real investigative journalism, like Robert Perry did back in the 70s, in the 80s with Iran-Contra. I mean, serious reporting. You don't see that anymore, and not in the way it used to be in that brief period in the 70s, that critical adversary relationship that the press had with government. So they neutralized corporate media. What's left, really, is WikiLeaks. They're the ones who are putting out the truth. And when they put out videos and documents that made the Republican administration of George W. Bush look bad, well, the Democratic press loved them. They put it on front page. Really liked it. Now, because he put out the Democratic Party emails that were given to him by someone, they hate him.
That's right.
So it's purely partisanship right now that we're seeing. And, you know, I have to say this about this persistent argument that why didn't Assange put out GOP emails? Well, he didn't get them.
Right. Yeah, he didn't put it.
He's not going out stealing the stuff.
Right,
he's receiving.
Right. That's exactly right. It's my conference table. Oh, when I woke up this morning, there was a big box from the DNC. Thanks. He's not going out and saying, hey, where's the RNC out the window? All he does is provide, here's the conference room. Here's the table. Put your file there. Hey, everybody, I got some files over here. Come check them out. That's his role. It's
number
like
one,
being a common carrier.
Stefania Morizzi from La Repubblica newspaper in Italy, who was a partner with WikiLeaks on various stories on the Podesta emails, she wrote in a piece that we also published on Consortium News about a week or two ago that they did receive some Trump emails, and they started to go through it, and then they discovered that they had been made public already before. Now, what was WikiLeaks supposed to do? They got this box on the conference room table with the DNC emails.
Right.
Nobody came in with any GOP emails except that one time, and then they realized they had already been published.
Right.
Is he supposed to sit on the DNC emails and say, no, we're not going to publish till we get the equal amount for them? Of course not.
No,
that's
not
totally irresponsible.
Right. That's right.
He had to publish that.
You know, and by the way, if that's how the media is supposed to work, then how come we don't see like a tenth of, say, Chuck Schumer's personal business history that we see of Donald Trump every day? Or somewhere in the whole Congress, out of 535 members of Congress, where, I don't know, maybe so 40% of them are Democrats, how come we don't see an aggregation of Democratic members of Congress, personal financial activities, sexual activity, whatever, spread across the media the way we do with Trump 24/7. In other words, there is a bias to the media that breaks down along this artificial, you know, this political party game that's heavily slanted against Trump and in favor of Democrats in Congress. How the Democrats could turn around and point to Assange and say, you're playing favorites, is beyond me. And again, it wasn't, he's not writing editorials. Here's documents. These are their documents.
Yeah. You raise an interesting point, because during the campaign, Trump was pretty much an open book.
Yep.
We kind of knew he was misogynist, I think.
Yep.
Maybe racist, or at least using racism.
Here's a tape of him in a parking lot.
He's corrupt, that he was a braggart. We didn't really need emails to
right.
But Hillary was much sneakier than that, and we did need the emails to confirm that our suspicions.
Yeah, she had a managed public image. Trump was, you know, all out there. He was doing that stuff on TV for years. They were pointing a camera at him saying, look at Trump, you know. Well, here, you know, news media, to draw eyes, one of the things they do is provide stuff outside of news for entertainment value. It used to be like astrology, and then it was People Page and sports, of course, you know, big things. You know, maybe you don't expect to see that kind of stuff in WikiLeaks. It's all going to be this droll, you know, internal office memos from one person to another. But I was pawing through there last week, and I stumbled on this gem. Madam Secretary, I'm sorry, dear Capricia, not sure if you were able to catch my interview with President Clinton last night on Piers Morgan. Do you think calling Secretary Clinton the greatest Secretary of State of all time shows just a touch of my bias? President Clinton is incredible. I hope our current president, who's as busy as can be, gets to see it. And then this is signed, all my best, Harvey. That's from Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, boy.
To the Clinton campaign. Talking about his PR work on CNN on behalf of Clinton's campaign the night before. This is June 1st of 2012. That's pretty odd. Yep. I guess when she's
exactly. That's an example. The nuggets you can get out of it. It's endless. Unfortunately, it's still online in a server secure somewhere, all these documents, so that researchers and historians and journalists can continually dig in there to find out what Harvey Weinstein was doing that night.
That's right.
Or whatever. You know, there's that's so right. much there. There's so many issues that and the press got so much material from him. And they publish that stuff.
That's right.
And why shouldn't they be prosecuted then, too?
That's right.
For publishing the same material. That's all Assange did was publish it.
That's right. That's
he was the
right.
He received it. He put it out. And then the press, or he gave it direct to the press before it was put online. So they would have scoops.
Yep. That's absolutely true.
Now, in Snowden's case, for example, he did take the documents. So he could be liable for stealing government property.
But
that's
the
not the case with Assange.
Right. He was the whistleblower, not the publisher of the.
Exactly.
Right. And it's funny, we both, among dozens of other journalists, put in some time with Susie Dawson on the massive effort she's been doing now for 3-4 months, a whole weekend of, it's an online vigil for Julian Assange, she calls it. She has a YouTube page, it's youtube.com, the channel is Susie, S-U-Z-I, 3D, the number 3 and the letter D. Her banner says, proof that America does export democracy, and it's next to a picture of Edward Snowden.
That's good. I hadn't seen that, yeah.
So,
yes, Susie's done an incredible job. It's a 50-hour marathon that she's running now, the first weekend of every month.
Yep.
And both you and I were privileged to go on there and talk for an hour.
Yep.
And next month there might be more. I had a chat with Susie, and then she's going to introduce a new system to this, so I won't reveal it.
Yep.
Until she does it, but it's going to be interesting how it's going to work next time.
I saw like Jimmy Dore, H.A. Goodman, Lionel, Margaret Kimberly, just oodles and oodles of journalists.
Dan Ellsberg.
Yeah,
John
by
Bilger,
the way. Yep, that's right.
John Kiriako, Chris Hedges.
Yeah, John was on right after me, actually. Yep, that's right. Yep. So
Chris Hedges was tremendous. Actually, his was last month, not this month.
Yeah, he's good.
I recommend people seeing that one. He was really, really good.
So while we're talking about that stuff, let's talk in general about what is on the front page of consortiumnews.com, because this is the you're the publisher, is that the term? What's your official job description?
Editor-in-chief.
Editor-in-chief. This is actually your work, your presentation of this stuff. And so we've got across the top the VIPs plead for humanitarian asylum for Julian Assange, and that's the group that has Ray McGovern and all those former intelligence officials for sanity. He'll have Journalists are all Julian Assange, which is a play from Bob Parry, the founder of the former editor of the consortiumnews.com, which details exactly who Julian is in the constellation of journalism. Then stuff around the world. What's going on? What happened in Belgrade in Yugoslavia in 1999? What's going on with the Syrian war? The VIPs to Trump intel on Iran could be catastrophic. Talk to us about some of the stories that are hot at consortiumnews.com.
Yeah, well, there's so many things to write about, and we're fortunate to have good people writing for us. And it's a mix, as you say. I have to say that Consortium News was begun in 1995 by Robert Parry, and he's, of course, the journalist who broke many of the Iran-Contra stories in the 80s, and particularly made Oliver North a household name, the Marine colonel working in the basement of the White House running this unbelievable conspiracy, proven conspiracy, which is that the U.S., of course, sold arms to Iran, the devil, the Iranian horrible mullahs that they said were the worst people in the world, but they were secretly selling arms to them through Israel, which is also an interesting part of that, and taking this money and illegally funding the so-called Contras in Nicaragua, which was the counter-revolution terrorists, really, against the Sandinista government after they had kicked out the dictator Somoza and their family and made Nicaragua a much more democratic place. And, of course, that could not be tolerated by the Reagan administration. Yep. But the Congress cut off the funding to the Contras because of all the crimes they had committed, including killing American clergy members who had gone down there. So Congress, that's their role under the Constitution, of course, is to fund the government and not the administration. So the administration decided, well, we're going to do it anyway. And they did this elaborate scheme. And Bob and his partner at AP, they ran several stories. But the one story they had, which was to nail the whole operation as far as Oliver North's role in this, was suppressed by his editors at AP. They kept saying, go back and get more documents, get more interviews. They had the story airtight. Finally, the editor told him, why can't you just get Oliver North to confess to this? Then we'll run the story, even though they had the guy nailed. Right. So the story was inadvertently translated into Spanish and put out on the AP Spanish wire.
Whoa.
And when that happened, that's when they had to put it out in English. It was too late. Mm. It's the only way we found out. So then he went to Newsweek, and Newsweek told me, can't run your story about Iran-Contra, or this was not Iran-Contra. This was Contra drug smuggling.
Right.
Because it's not good for the country. Of course, that's what his editor told him at Newsweek. And what he meant, the country, didn't mean all of us. He meant
the government.
The rulers of the country, yes. Yeah. Or top editors like himself at Newsweek. So Bob got fed up and started the Consortium for Independent Journalism, 1995, Consortium News, a place for journalists like that who were running up against walls to publish their work. And he's been doing it. He was doing it until, unfortunately, he became ill last December with a stroke, and within a month he died. And I had joined Consortium 6 years before that because I was exactly for the reasons he created it. I was running up against editors at the Wall Street Journal who were blocking my stories on Palestine, on Ukraine, on Syria, and I went and published this stuff with Bob. And it eventually got me fired from the Wall Street Journal because they found out about this. Somebody ratted me out. I mean, it was 4 years I was doing this before somebody ratted me out. It's the best thing ever happened to get out of the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
So we are – Bob then, towards the end of his life, was really made a mark for being a skeptic on Russiagate, which we could talk 10 hours about. But he did not accept the notion that there was serious evidence out there, that it was all based on anonymous intelligence sources in the corporate media saying these things, that intelligence assessment of January 17th was not serious because only three agencies and handpicked agents inside those agencies took part, and they really did not provide any evidence. And there's even a disclaimer in there that this is basically opinion.
Right.
And then he took on the he was writing a lot about Russia, and it became a place to go to get Bob's Take, and others, because I wrote a bunch of Russiagate stories, as others did, to get the critical, skeptical view, doing what is the bedrock of journalism, which is skepticism. Never closed the door on possible involvement of Russia in any of this.
Right.
But we had to publish, we had to say, well, we haven't seen the evidence yet. We Assange is denying that he got the emails from Russia. He's putting out that it could have been a leak, not a hack from the DNC computers by a whistleblower, the way he gets most of his stuff.
Right.
So Bob died, and I've tried to keep it going. I tried to diversify beyond Russiagate, but I'm finding just by looking at our analytics here that most of the stories, the top 12 stories over the last 3 months have all been about Russia. Yeah. People not that interested in our stories.
Well,
we're going to on Syria, on Belgrade, on Iran, etc.
I mean, this is, you know, perhaps a mirror effect of the general media scape, because none of them are covering Syria or any of these other stories. They're covering Russiagate, even though, you know, if you look for evidence, there's
from the
no
other side, yeah.
Yeah, there's no there. So when if people are saying, okay, well, I don't believe what I'm looking at, let me see what other people are writing about it. Of course, that's going to be the hot topic.
Yeah.
You know?
It is, and we're going to do more of it now. But and I had to write pieces when the indictments came down by Mueller recently, right, of the 12 GRU agents,
right,
which are only indictments, allegations, not evidence, although that's the way it's spoken about in the corporate media, as if this is a conviction of, right, these guys. We'll, right, never see that evidence, Dom, because those guys will never be arrested. And if they were, they cannot be extradited. There's an extradition treaty. So they'll never have to go to court. They could write whatever they want in that indictment, basically.
Right. I mean,
because they will never have to be challenged.
That's right. And which means that there's no cross-examination, no counter evidence, rebuttal evidence, no new evidence presented by the other side, which is the point of an adversarial justice system. If you're going to find truth, you let each side bring their truth to the court. And if one side's not coming, you can rig the outcome pretty easily.
And even if they did go to court, they have another thing, ace up their sleeves, which is they can invoke state secret privilege.
Right.
Meaning our evidence is, unfortunately, Your Honor, our evidence is classified.
That's
so
right.
We're going to have to go into your chambers, and you have clearance, because we knew this was going to happen. And we'll show you the evidence, and you'll,
right,
come back to the courtroom, even if there's a jury there,
right,
and say guilty.
Right. That's
I'm
right.
Sorry, you can't. The public and the jury cannot see the evidence, but they're guilty.
It's an amazing condition.
That's what they would do in that case.
That's so right.
That's a democratic system of justice.
That's
joke.
Right. That's the one we live with. Well, I'm really glad that we're able to grab you today, Joe, and I look forward to speaking with you again here. Keep up the good work.
Don, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. After 3 years of conflict, it has been estimated that out of a population of 27.4 million, 22.2 million people in Yemen are in need of humanitarian assistance. 4.5 million children and women are suffering malnutrition, while 2.9 million people are internally displaced. This is a humanitarian catastrophe by any measure. So why are the U.S. and U.K. so committed to the Saudi-UAE war on Yemen? Crosstalking the tragedy known as Yemen, I'm joined by my guest, Mohamed Mirandi in Tehran. He's a professor at the University of Tehran. In London, we have Charles Shoebridge. He is a security analyst and a former UK Army and counterterrorism intelligence officer. And in Brighton, we cross to Catherine Shakdam. She is a senior analyst with Al Bayan Center. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Charles first. This war has been going on for 3 years. I gave some of the stats. I encourage our viewers to go to Doctors Without Frontiers and look at their site on Yemen, much more detailed, much more gruesome, I would even say. What is the UK U.S. interest in this war against the country, the poorest country in the Middle East. What is the thinking behind British foreign policy supporting Saudi Arabia and the Emirates against Yemen?
I suspect on the one hand that you've got UK and the US seeing that to some degree, and we can come on to that later on, their national interests are aligned with those of Saudi Arabia, particularly against Iran, of course, in Yemen as elsewhere. And again, you have to question, and hopefully later in the program we will do that in more detail, as to why the UK and US always seem to see their interests as being in conflict with Iran in most instances. But also there's got to be a aspect of this which is based on commercial interests. Of course, Britain and America supply vast amounts of weaponry and other equipment to Saudi Arabia. The relationship with Saudi Arabia, particularly, it's not just Saudi Arabia involved here as well, of course, other Gulf states as well, all of which have very lucrative commercial contacts with Britain and the United States, and indeed France. And there has been, certainly over the last few years, a tendency for, particularly in the United Kingdom, that anything that Saudi Arabia supports, pretty much Britain and America are going to support also. And we have to remember just really how important this relationship, particularly with Saudi Arabia, is. If we think about Trump, we think about other government ministers in the United States and the United Kingdom, their first port of call when they've been put into office isn't their allies in Europe or the States often. It's usually going off to see two players, both of whom are vitally important to British and particularly American interests. One of those is Israel, the other one always Saudi Arabia. And so really, I think this war is becoming increasingly an embarrassment, not just war, but the blockade and everything else that goes with it is becoming an embarrassment to Western leaders, as invariably parts of it creep into media coverage because there's been a near blackout, as we know, the last 3 years.
Creep.
But also they will continue to support it.
Catherine, let me go to you in Brighton. Okay, so we've got a little bit of the background, the reason why, if we can use that term, for the British and the Americans. So what does victory mean in Yemen for the Saudis and in the UAE? Genocide? I mean, what do they hope to, what is the end goal here? Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, the end goal was basically the situation that we had prior to 2011, when the people decided to rise up against the then regime, whereas Saudi Arabia was in control of Yemen and Yemen's political future as well as economical future. And I think that this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to revert back to the situation that we had pre-2011. But it's not going to happen because people have learned that they have a right to political self-determination. And they understand today, most, the majority of Yemeni understand that Saudi Arabia is not there to promote a greater Yemen or even to promote a greater future for Yemen, but rather, to have yet another country, a clan state that will remain forever tied up to Yemen. If I may, just very quickly, when we talk about, British and the U.S. Siding with Saudi Arabia because of the fear and animosity that they have towards Iran, we need to be very careful here to understand that Yemen is a proxy only in the eyes of Britain and the U.S., because there is no Iranian influence. But Yemen represents geographically an advantage in that it's sitting on very important waterways, militarily and, of course, because of the oil route, which is why Britain and the U.S. are interested in Yemen in the first place. It has really nothing to do with the fact that Iran has an eye on Yemen, but rather because of the geography and where Yemen is situated in relation to Iran and the rest of the Gulf countries. And I think it's an important point, because we need to stop this narrative that Iran, has an interest in trying to promote unrest in Yemen. That's not the case. If anything, Iran needs stability in the region to be able to itself, stabilize its own borders and everything else that goes with it.
I think that, Catherine, I'm really glad you brought that up, because there is a self-determination issue in Yemen that is never brought up in the mainstream media. And Charles already brought up the issue that is always mentioned. I'm going to go to Mohammed now in Tehran. It's all Iran's fault, as usual. I mean, pick the day of the week. It's Russia's fault or Iran's fault here. Now, I'm willing to agree that Iran may have some kind of involvement on some level now, but not in 2011. That was how it was sold, the Saudi intervention in the first place here. But it's always Iran's fault. It's a proxy war. It's far more than a proxy war, as Catherine has pointed out. Go ahead, Mohammed, in Tehran.
Well, this is one of the excuses that Western countries and the Western media use in order to justify the crimes being committed by their governments, the Canadian government, the American, British, and French governments, are involved in crimes against humanity. And they are just as guilty as Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudi regime and all this. Without them, he couldn't be carrying out these crimes. The Americans are providing all sorts of logistical support, so they need to justify it somehow. Obviously, for anyone who knows anything about what's going on, the Yemenis do not have the ability to have any meaningful contact with Iran. There's no way that the Iranians can help them in a meaningful way because they are completely surrounded. The Americans and the Saudis and others have laid siege on the country. They're preventing food from getting in. They're enforcing starvation. They've been doing this for years now. And the Western media, they call it a proxy war, or they try to somehow blame the victims, like in Gaza, in order to, again, justify their policies. But it's obvious that this country is surrounded. The overwhelming majority of the population is living in the areas controlled by the Ansarullah and their allies, the popular committees and so on. After all these years, after over 3.5 years, with all the foreign support, American support, European support, mercenaries from different countries, Blackwater, and an American and French official military presence on the ground, Sudanese mercenaries. After all, you know, with all the money that the Saudis and the Emiratis are spending, if they cannot capture the capital of the country, that shows that it is the will of the people of Yemen that prevents them from doing so. That shows that the resistance against the Saudis and the Americans is a legitimate and popular resistance. But that's something that they don't want to see, because that makes CNN, that makes the New York Times, the Guardian, the BBC, all of them run against their own government. If they point these out, that humiliates their own government position.
Charles, I have noticed that what scant coverage there is on the cable stations, the Iran card is almost always played first. Okay, and there isn't a willingness to admit that serious war crimes are being committed. And I'd like to point out that the Houthis also have been accused of that. In all fairness, but this is a very tragic conflict. What is the end game here? Because I mean, just reading the stats, I mean, this is a country, a humanitarian situation that is winding down, winding out of control in a very serious way. I mean, cholera, I mean, something that is virtually wiped out in the world has come back in a vengeance there. And there seems to be no outcry whatsoever from the media. I mean, it makes them culpable. Go ahead, Charles.
Or if there is outcry, as you've already kind of hinted at, it's at a humanitarian situation that seems to have risen out of nothing, that this is a famine, that there are hundreds of thousands of children not in education, that there is, as you say, for the second year running, now the danger of a cholera epidemic breaking out, as if this has got nothing to do with the fact that this war has been visited upon this people by Saudi Arabia and its allies. But particularly, of course, what's missing from the Western media coverage is that this war, this assault on this country, as you point out, one of the poorest countries on earth and facing terrible predicament for its people, that this assault on this country is enabled totally by Britain, America and France, particularly Britain and America, in supplying the weapons that are being used against the Yemeni people. And of course, study after study from independent organizations, from monitoring groups, human rights groups, as well as the UN itself, have shown repeatedly that there has been almost no care taken to prevent civilian casualties. We're talking about the humanitarian situation that is largely being caused by the blockade that is in place, that is preventing medicines and foods arriving. As we speak, even fighting going on, of course, the assault has been launched on the major Houthi-held port by the Saudis and the Emiratis, again with British and American and French not only material cover by providing the materials, the logistical support, the intelligence, the refueling and arming capabilities, but the weapons themselves, but also diplomatic and propaganda cover. For example, it was Britain, France and America that blocked the Swedish initiative a few days ago to actually call a ceasefire. And that was actually virtually absent from UK and US media coverage. And one other aspect I would just quickly mention, what Catherine mentioned, and to support what she said. It's interesting about the Iran angle, as you mentioned, always being brought up. But in 3 years, no actual hard evidence has been shown whatsoever, even by those that claim that Iran is backing the Houthis, to prove that
I'm going to jump in here, and we have to remember that in December of last year, the Pentagon admitted it had troops on the ground. We're going to go to a short break, and after a short break, that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Yemen. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Catherine on Skype in Brighton. Well, as we've already pointed out in this program, and you put it quite definitively in the first part of the program, the people of Yemen do not want to be occupied. They've proven over the last 3 years to be quite resistant to that, even though the casualties are high in every single way. There has never been any solid documentation that Iran is helping militarily or in any kind of meaningful material way. So what is facing the Saudis and the UAE in the Emirates? I mean, it doesn't. Are they going to have a land invasion and occupy it? I mean, the people of Yemen have shown themselves to be quite resilient to the onslaught that they've experienced over the last 3.5 years. Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, yes. I mean, historically, Yemen was never invaded. Even the Ottoman Empire actually, gave up and allowed Yemen to have a great degree of autonomy. And it really goes to show that, the Saudi are not really good at brushing up on their history, bearing in mind that Yemen is actually their direct neighbor. Now, when it comes to, a military victory, I don't think it's going to happen because if the south of Yemen might actually give up and actually open it open up itself to, the UAE or Saudi Arabia, I very much doubt that the North will give up because, they are very different people altogether. And for very obvious reason, they understand that any occupation by Saudi Arabia would mean an entire genocide for them because Saudi Arabia is very sectarian in its approach and has made sure that, the Houthi, Ansar Allah, the resistance movement in general and Northern Yemen globally has been labeled under this, this Shia title and therefore should be obliterated. We tend to forget this. The Saudi are not just out there to gain victory. What they're trying to do is annihilate an entire people because of their religious standing, their religious belief, and their tradition. Forget a little bit about the civilian casualty and understand that they're not collateral damage. The Saudi have architected this war to inflict maximum damage on civilians because he wants the people to rise up against the resistance movement, not understanding that the resistance movement in itself is made out of the people. The legitimacy that Ansar Allah has is given by the people of Yemen. It's not being created out of thin air. And therefore, a victory for the Saudi is, by definition, impossible. The people will not allow it. But in the meantime, we're facing a catastrophe of biblical proportion. Because Northern Yemen is being decimated for only one reason, is that these people decided to be free in their own land, in their own sovereignty. So the real question is, are we actually willing in Western countries to defend a nation such as Saudi Arabia and actually give up and forfeit our own rights to our own sovereignty and own democracy? Because this is what we're doing by allowing a country to unlawfully declare war on another in Yemen.
Right. Exactly. Let me go back to Mohammed in Tehran. I mean, we see some kind of peace overture process with North Korea about nuclear weapons, and then we kind of go on the other side of the world and we have Iran. And considering the cast of characters that surround President Trump, I'm not hopeful at all on what's going to happen when it comes to Iran. I have a distinct worry that they're going to use this humanitarian crisis, given the way the media works. Is they going to say this is Iran's fault because of Iran's involvement? And that's just another box that is checked in this agenda that looking at regime change in Iran, punishing Iran, more sanctions, et cetera, et cetera. And this is when they'll pull out the pictures. This is when they're going to have the crying mothers and the skinny babies. That's when they're going to start showing those pictures. They have them all saved up and archived, and that's when they're going to use it. That's my supposition, okay? Go ahead, Mohammed.
I think it's quite obvious that what is different in this part of the world is the Saudi-Israeli alliance and their relationship with the White House and the United States political regime in general. Recently, we saw another airstrike on Bu Kamal in the east of Syria, where either the Americans or the Israelis bombed Iraqi and Syrian forces that were fighting ISIS. But this is something that the Western media won't touch. Why? Because it's in the interest of the Israeli regime, it's in the interest of the Americans to keep Syria unstable and to strengthen Israel. That is the criteria through which everything is judged. And in the case of Yemen, we see the exact same thing. Because Yemen is opposed to Saudi Arabia, the people of Yemen are opposed to Saudi Arabia, they don't want to legitimize this resistance. So they have to find a scapegoat. And that scapegoat is, of course, Iran. Whether it's in Gaza, whether it's in Syria, whether it's in Iraq, everything is Iran. And I think it's very racist, the way in which Western countries the Western media ignore what's happening in Yemen, which is the greatest catastrophe so far in this century. But on the other hand, I think what's important is that the Saudis are losing the war. Despite all the propaganda in Al-Hudaydah, the Saudis have been unable to capture the city. They've been unable to capture the airport. They face serious casualties. We have, according to the resistance in Yemen, the Americans have a command post in Buraiqa and Mukha in support of the attacks. We know, for example, that Al-Qaeda in Yemen, as the head of Al-Qaeda said last year, that they are fighting alongside the Saudi and UAE-backed forces, which is not strange because that's exactly what happened in Libya. Al-Qaeda was used to overthrow Gaddafi. And look at Libya today, just the fighting right now that's been taking place over the last few days, or what we saw in Syria. And of course, in Syria, the Western media likes to say that President Assad has killed hundreds of thousands of his own people. But in reality, it was Obama and his allies that are responsible for these deaths. And in Yemen, if you notice, they always say, it's for 3.5 years now, they've been saying 10,000 people have died. And where in reality, hundreds of thousands of people have died. But they try to downplay the casualties in Yemen, try to hide them, even though hundreds of thousands of people have died from cholera, from starvation and other sicknesses, preventable sicknesses. And whereas in Iraq and Syria, they were trying to inflate it, despite the fact that they were in reality the side that was responsible more than anyone else.
Okay, let me go to Charles in London. We ought to point out also that a number of international aid groups are leaving Yemen because of the humanitarian crisis, being there to help, but it's getting to such a critical point that they can't even protect their own people. I want to stay with Charles in London. I mean, I looked at how the Pentagon has reacted to all this. They say that they are solely targeting Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. Does that cut any... Does that make any sense to you? I mean, that's what they say, but it seems to me that if they're giving logistical support, then I guess all these Al-Qaeda people are in wedding processions all the time, okay? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, America and Britain, as often, they're playing a double game. They will say one thing in public, and in private, they're doing something else. So, for example, they will say that they urge restraint on Israel, that they urge restraint on Saudi Arabia. And then behind the scenes, it's clear they're saying, that's all you're going to hear from us. Where's the next check for the next weapons load that you're going to use to carry out these humanitarian atrocities? In Yemen, it's absolutely clear that one of the main reasons why Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is still a problem for the West is because of the instability in that country. In the same way that ISIS came out of the instability created by the West, or at least largely fostered by the West, in Iraq and Syria, and now, of course, also, as was pointed out, in Libya. And so, and then, of course, notice how in Syria, the existence of ISIS on the ground, even though that is waning largely as a result of being crushed by forces such as Hezbollah, the Iranian militia, Assad and the Russian Air Force and so on, that the presence of ISIS is then used by the United States and Britain as a justification for having troops and a presence on the ground. And there's probably some element of that in why the Americans are still active in Yemen. But the main reason is to support the Saudi onslaught. The Saudis have proved again and again that regardless of the massive amount of military capability they have, that in terms of actually putting that to use, they are not actually that competent. They've shown that repeatedly, and therefore they are largely reliant on Western logistical intelligence and other support. But let's put something as well, throw something into the mix here. For example, within the last 3 years, Britain's arms exports to Saudi Arabia, they equate to something like $10 billion. Half of all Britain's arms exports go to one country, Saudi Arabia. And that's on top of the massive Saudi and incidentally also Qatari influence that these countries have on the City of London in terms of ownership of stocks and shares, companies, and also real estate. And let's not forget as well the massive flotation that's coming up of the a large part of the Saudi sovereign wealth fund, the oil fund, that is going to come up in the next few months, for which London is and New York are absolutely vying to achieve the flotation on their markets. And so to support Saudi Arabia, for Britain, or at least the elites running Britain and America as well, when you look at political donations to the ruling elites that are running these countries, the role of Saudi Arabia, like Israel, is absolutely vital. And the sad thing is that they put on one side the massive lucrative gains that are to be had from continuing this relationship, this toxic relationship with a country like Saudi Arabia. On the other side is the suffering and the deaths of and the creation of a humanitarian catastrophe, which is largely not being reported in the West and certainly isn't being reported as anything in which Britain and America are complicit.
Okay. The latter part of what you said, Charles, it's just shameful. It's just utterly shameful. And having the media cover because of stock prices. Oh, my goodness. Catherine, there are reports that the Pentagon is hesitating a little bit with this last major report, Hodeida, because they know if they allow the Emirates to capture it and shut it down, then the humanitarian crisis just gets accelerated. Somebody in the Pentagon is a little worried about this. That's just reports I read. Last 40 seconds of the program go to you, Catherine. Go ahead.
I don't know if they're really worried about the humanitarian catastrophe. I think they're actually worried that they're going to lose, you know, this battle for the seaport of Hodeida, because I don't think that Yemen resistance movement will allow it to fall, and they will throw everything that they've got against it. So I think it's more to do with, you know, having to lose very publicly a very geostrategic, you know, seaport in northern Yemen, rather than really caring for humanitarian crisis, because this crisis has gone on for 3 years and millions of people have already suffered and continue to suffer. So I don't think that Washington is very preoccupied, you know, by civilian suffering and casualties. I think it has more to do with losing very publicly a very important battle for Yemen, because, you know, if Hodeida doesn't fall, the Saudi have lost more than just the war. They have lost their standing in the region.
Okay, Catherine, I have to jump in here. We've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in London, Brighton, and in Tehran. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.